Hey, this is Cedric, your host of the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. And before we get into this super fun rip with Dan and Josh, the awesome fellas from the Blue Collar Bitcoin podcast, I want to tell you about our amazing sponsors. The only way to truly own your Bitcoin is to get your BTC off your exchange and into a hardware wallet that you control. This is really important. And you need to make sure that you secure your Bitcoin from physical disaster and a single point of failure. And you can use a CipherGrid seed storage device to get started. It's the best value in the industry because you get everything you need for $59. This seed storage device has privacy by default, two brass plates for all 24 seed words. It can be locked with a padlock, tamper evidence seal provided, automatic center punch provided. Just like all Cypher Safe products, it's fireproof, rustproof, and waterproof. To keep your sats safe, go to cyphersafe.io and use the code MATRIX to get 10% off your order. Between working from home, mandates, and lockdowns, you might be thinking about adding an extra room at the house or renting a place to escape or retreat from encroaching communism. Citadel Cabins is in the custom building industry, and they are famous for small log cabins that can be shipped anywhere and easily assembled by you and a couple of friends in just a few days without any specialized skills or power tools required. Imagine adding a room to your house or dropping a cabin in the woods. As we descend deeper and deeper into clown world, the cabins are creating a way for families like mine to escape and establish KYC-free location sovereignty, surrounded by people who care about freedom as much as we do. Or maybe you want to get off the grid completely. Citadel Cabins is a Bitcoin-only company that exists to help individuals achieve shelter, rest, security, and location independence. Head over to CitadelCabins.com for more information and to fill out an application now. Ledin is a secure, simple, and easy-to-use platform for managing and growing your digital wealth. Ledin.io is the first digital asset lender with the transparency and security of a formal proof of reserves attestation, raising the bar in the space. You can borrow against your Bitcoin if you don't want to sell, or you can use their B2X program if you want to take advantage of this dip and double your stack. Listeners of the Bitcoin Matrix podcast get $50 in USDC when you become a Ledin user and take out a Ledin loan. If you want to see what it's all about, head over to start.ledin.io/Bitcoin Matrix. Bitcoin 2022 is the largest Bitcoin event ever, and it takes place April 6th to 9th in Miami. These 4 days will be jam-packed with exclusive content, exciting announcements, and an incredible lineup of Bitcoin speakers, artists, and thinkers. Think Coachella for Bitcoin. Day one is Industry Day for enterprising Bitcoiners who are looking to build a business or career within the ecosystem. Days two and three are the big conference days, featuring speakers like the president of El Salvador, who has promised a big surprise, as well as CEOs like Michael Saylor, Elizabeth Stark, Jack Mahlers, Adam Back, and hundreds more. The conference caps off on the fourth day with the world's first and largest Bitcoin music festival, the Sound Money Fest, headlined by Logic, Run the Jewels, deadmau5, and many more. Visit b.tc/conference to get your tickets before prices increase on March 18th. And make sure to use the promo code Bitcoin Matrix for 10% off. And I will see you in Miami. And now let's enter the Bitcoin Matrix with Dan and Josh from the Blue Collar Bitcoin podcast, where we talk finance, we talk economics, we talk about Bitcoin, the most important monetary technology of the 21st century. And of course, we talk some shit.
What is real? How do you define real?
You can't jump into cash. Cash is trash. What do? You get out.
Dan and Josh are two firefighters who started a fresh and dope podcast called the Blue Collar Bitcoin Podcast to get the word out. They talk Bitcoin, they talk finance, and they talk shit. Dan and Josh, welcome to the Bitcoin Matrix Podcast. How are you guys?
Doing well.
Fantastic, Cedric.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, guys. I'm super excited to have you guys on. You guys certainly have a lot of buzz going. I think it's really interesting, the angle that you guys are looking at Bitcoin from. And I think you guys have a great rapport. And you guys, like I said in the top of the show, just have this sort of fresh and dope vibe. And, you know, I'm really enjoying what you guys are putting out. And, you know, I also want to thank Greg Foss. He kind of put me on to you guys. I know he's been on the show a couple of times, but he DM'd me and he was like, you got to get in touch with these guys. They're in your area, in your neck of the woods. So I'd love to get to know a little bit more about you guys, specifically around firefighting. Maybe how long you guys been firefighters? I know there are different kind of firefighters. So what part or role do you play? And we'll just get into it from there.
Perfect. Thanks for having us, Cedric. We're really excited to just chill, bro, down here tonight. Yeah, we are career firefighter paramedics. So we both work at the same department. We're good buddies, as comes through in our show. The dual role means like we do the firefighting thing, and then the ambulance, you know, EMS service also runs out of the same firehouses. So we kind of work in a typical suburb, 40, 50,000 people. We got three stations. You know, one day you're driving a fire truck, the next day you're on the ambulance. So it's some nice variety. I've been doing it for 5 years. Josh, what are you, around 10?
Yeah, I just crossed over 10 in January. So it's been an experience, man. And it's like anything, like people, you know, they watch Chicago Fire and they think that all we do is the cool stuff, like, you know, cutting people out of cars. And actually the other day, my last shift, we actually had an old lady who drove her car into a pond that was frozen, obviously. She had done circles in this pond because they were tread marks. You could see where she was a senile old lady. She drove into a pond, circled the pond for like 5 minutes or 10 minutes. And then her car fell through the ice. And that was out of the norm. You know, like we don't usually see people drive their cars into ice and like extricated her and all that. So that was a cool, it's kind of out of the norm experience. But a lot of times it's just it's like any other job. Like it's mundane to the point of like most of the time people fall down and we go pick them up and drive them to the hospital.
Yeah. Sure.
But yeah, it once in a while they throw you a curveball and something cool, crazy happens.
I think it's like anything too. We love the job, but you do just grow desensitized to whatever you do. So
yeah, exactly.
There is something almost energizing and fun when you encounter new people that still think it's cool. Cause to us, it's we really appreciate it and we're grateful to have the gig, but it's what we do for a living. You know, it's how we provide for our family. So when you encounter other people that still think fire trucks are cool and sirens get them giddy, it's fun to kind of share and remember what it was like when we didn't know what it was all about, which it's a great gig. There's variety every day. You know, I think that's one of the things I appreciate the most about being a firefighter is that every day you go into work, you have absolutely no idea what's going to come down the pipe. And, there's something fun and energizing about that. And then just the camaraderie. I mean,
yeah, I couldn't agree more on that.
The camaraderie is really special and unique. I don't think it's something you get many other places. Cause like in our area, once you land a job at a good agency, you never leave. I mean, we barely have anyone leave. So you're doing a 25 to 35 year career. So you have all this conglomeration of generations, right? You've got 23 year olds that just started and 60 year olds on their way out. So there's this familial vibe there. And then it is like as hokey as it sounds, it's like a brotherhood and a sisterhood. I mean, we get to know each other intimately, you know, flaws, strengths, you brush your teeth next to each other. So it is obviously there's trade-offs there, but it's really fun. And there's few things more hilarious than coffee in the morning at a firehouse at shift change, which is it's very cool.
Right. Well, you know, I get that, you know, there's a lot of variety, but there's also, I guess, some mundaneness. You're eating with the same guys every day. Maybe you're sleeping there. But so there's a lot of, it's a little closer than I think your average coworker.
Yeah, for sure.
Long periods of time, usually a lot of continuity. So a lot of camaraderie. But I think at the end of the day, from time to time, I'm sure there's the opportunity or the potential to be risking your lives. and working alongside each other. And I think that adds another component to it. And what I think is also interesting is, like, say someone like maybe Jack Mahler's, another Chicagoan and Evanstonian, where I'm at. Jack, you know, made the comment that, you know, he would die on this hill. And, you know, maybe I've even heard him speak at a Chicago BitDevs meeting a few weeks ago. We went on a little bit further and he said, you know, prior to meeting President Bukele, you know, I got a text like, meet us at these coordinates. And, you know, he called his dad and he was like, Pop, you know, I'm a good person. You know, I'm in this for the right reasons. And, you know, I'm really scared to go, you know, to meet these people. I don't know what's going to happen here. I don't know if guns are going to be drawn. And his dad and his mom are like, well, maybe you shouldn't go. You know, and so there's so little component to maybe he would die on this hill or in the risk he's taking. But most people don't have risk in their job. And so from that perspective, I'm kind of curious what this journey has been like with Bitcoin. And I'll get to why that sort of underpins this. But I'd love to hear what your rabbit hole stories were.
For me, it could be a long story. I'll try to keep it kind of short. But I worked at a financial institution in 2008, and I watched from, I guess, the backseat of what was going on in this whole thing. I was pretty young at the time. I was like 24, had really no idea what finance was or how it worked. But I watched this entire thing topple. I watched people get laid off. And one of the things I remember most prominently about that time is that the CEO of the company I worked at doubled down and backed up the truck and bought as much stock as he possibly could at the time, which I thought was interesting. And so after trying to diving down this rabbit hole, I was a huge gold bug after that, after understanding hard money at the time. So from 2008 to maybe 2014, 15, huge gold bug, read everything I could find on Austrian Econ. And that led me pretty naturally to Bitcoin over time. And, I think I'd also credit the book Sapiens for finally being the last thing that just set me over the edge. Like, this digital scarcity thing, it has a lot of merit. And this is gold transitioning into the digital space. And I have to have as much exposure to this as I can possibly get. And of course, like anyone or most people, I shitcoined the hell out of 2017. That's the year I figured this all out, at least partly. And yeah, dragged as many people down that rabbit hole as I could, kicking and screaming.
And what about you, Dan?
Yeah, Josh is kind of the first mover at the agency we work at. There's a lot of people that have fallen in place after him. Yeah, so my journey in to this space. So a little background on me. I don't have a degree in anything related to finance or econ. I actually have an undergrad in biblical and theological studies and rhetoric communication.
Dan has started the Church of Bitcoin.
Yeah, exactly. I grew up in a very
totally qualified.
Yeah. I grew up in a really conservative religious context, which I still have a lot of endearment for, but I've moved in a very different direction. But studied that growing up. Always have just been kind of as I think many Bitcoiners are, just a voracious learner. I mean, my favorite thing to do in life is explore and learn. So, and Josh and I get made fun of at the firehouse all the time. Like, you losers don't want to watch this basketball game. What the hell are you doing? You know, reading books and listening to podcasts.
We're watching Lynn Alden.
So, I get out of college. I kind of shifted gears. I decided to do something completely different for a career out of school. I played golf in high school and college, and I went into the golf business. So I got what's called my Class A PGA membership. And I was a assistant manager at a golf facility. Liked it, but didn't feel like it was the best fit for our family. There's a long story transitioning into the fire service, but made that transition. And kind of along this whole journey from college till now, I've had this just growing fascination with finance, investing, and economics. Started out in more of like your traditional camp, like don't get too cute, stay the course, long-term fundamentals, free up your cash flow, buy assets over 30 years, you'll be okay. Like an instrumental book for me was John Bogle's Little Book of Common Sense Investing, like get out of your own way and whatever. But I think as years went on and I started to study more, I recognized that there were some cracks in the way the system works. So now introduce Josh. We now work at the same department. We kind of recognize we're kindred spirits. We're bouncing ideas off each other all the time. And I still remember the moment when he came to me and explained what this Bitcoin thing was back in 2017. And I've said before, like, I feel like both Josh and I had just enough of a few different disciplines to kind of understand the implications of this thing. He kind of gave me the short spiel. I remember like sitting there and thinking, and I remember one of my first thoughts being something to the effect, maybe the words in my head weren't exactly like this, but there's no way this thing credibly enforces a supply cap. Like nothing like that exists in the world, right? But it was enough for me to explore further. The first book I ever read was Andreas Antonopoulos's Internet of Money. He was kind of the bigwig in the education space back in like the 2017 time period. So just soaked in literally every video he had on YouTube and was like, holy crap, this is significant for sure. And at that point was kind of in the like, hey, take a small hedge. I was sort of in the 3 to 5%, you know, hedge your investment portfolio with this thing. As the years have gone on, that hedge has increased in size, as Josh likes to chuckle about. But I think similar to many plebs, like every single stone I've turned over on this journey, I'm in more awe of the implications of this paradigm shifting protocol. And you know, this year in 2021, Josh was the one that got the idea for the show. And we just decided, hey, let's just do this. This is an excuse to maybe talk to some people we're interested in. And
it really wasn't even my idea. It was just people at the firehouse and, you know, they're like, dude, all you guys talk about is Bitcoin. Why don't you shut the fuck up and go talk about it, you know, without us having to listen to everything.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So we did.
So yeah, we kind of launched the show sort of just exploring, the two of like our first few episodes, which are, probably a little more rough around the edges, but are just the two of us just covering topics, you know, the history of money, what fiat is, why the system's broken, this and that. And after, you know, whatever, exploring for 4 or 5 episodes, we decided to keep rolling with it. And yeah, it's been a really, really fun, rewarding, mind stretching journey, so far this last year. And we have no plans to move another direction. It's an awesome excuse to talk to thought leaders we would otherwise have no opportunity to speak with.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I love what you guys are doing with the show. I love the evolution of the show, and you guys have really ripped out some bangers lately. There's a lot to unpack there as well. Do you guys remember maybe your early conversations around even pre-Bitcoin, exploring sort of macroeconomics, finance? What were you guys sort of getting at there? Was it really just looking for alpha? Was it trying to protect your future? I mean, like, it's not often that, I mean, there's not too many ongoing dialogues that one might have with a coworker around broader subjects of money.
Yeah, you're right. This is a years long dialogue between the two of us. I mean, we've been growing, learning together for 5 years now.
Right.
Yeah. And I also think that at the firehouse, you kind of touched on this a little bit. There's a different dynamic there than like a traditional workplace. Like we talk a lot of shit. We say things at the firehouse. Of course, we don't actually do this. This is just the chief was listening to this. We don't say anything, you know, out of color at all.
It's all locked up.
We have a comfort level with each other that is probably very rare in a traditional professional workplace. And so people share and talk about things that you would not expect at a normal workplace. And finance is an interest that Dan and I have shared for a long time. So we just dive down those rabbit holes for hours on end and people either listen or they walk away. But either way, I just think that we share a lot of more intimate details with each other than you would expect in a typical workplace.
And there's more room for confrontation. Like you can sharpen ideas with somebody when there's that level of comfort. There's not that insecurity that the relationship's going to end or whatever. I mean, we're strapped in at this department for 20 more years together.
And there's all kinds of terrible ideas too. I mean, people are bouncing all kinds of crazy conspiracy theories around. There's XRP maximalists. You got
everything.
Kind of a person that you can imagine is floating around in there. Like we've got everything from the extreme liberal side to the extreme conservative side, me, the crazy libertarian, and you know, everyone else. All it's pretty wide ranging, I guess I'd say.
Yeah.
In terms of your question about like, what were some topics we were discussing pre-Bitcoin or early in our Bitcoin journey? there's kind of two things I think themes that we both agreed on even pre-Bitcoin. First is that we recognize that for someone our age investing for the long term, owning fixed income is not a good idea. So even pre-Bitcoin, I've had zero fixed income in my portfolio for 10 years. And that's something the two of us resonated on, just being privileged enough to understand some of the basics of where we're at in a debt cycle and the likely future trajectory and the length of time we're going to be investing. So that was kind of the one of the two things we agreed on right away. I think another thing that resonated for the two of us was that when you're in an environment like we're in, you see a lot of people get way too cute with money, both in two capacities. First of all, you have a lot of like pseudo experts, quote unquote, right? That are, you know, doing all these trades and working the stock market angle and all this stuff. And there's this thought that they're going to outperform the market, right? And I think the two of us have had long-term conviction that like for the average firefighter, the chances that you're going to outcompete like long-term DCA buy and hold strategies and tried and true, you know, hatching a specific plan over the long term, like the chances you're going to succeed in that capacity are minimal, right? So steering people away from presuming that they're an expert in a field that they're far from it. The other thing is just encouraging. I think we both agreed early on, like there's a lot of people in the middle class that don't have any free cash flow, right? The system we're in right now has incentivized people to spend out their ears, right? People are just absolutely at the red line in terms of what they can afford, how much debt they can take on. I mean, you look in the back parking lot of our fire station, it's jaw dropping what some of the vehicles back there. And I'm all about, we have guys that can afford it and we have guys that can't. We have people in both categories, right? But just this conviction that you need to get your budget squared away so that you can buy productive assets to, you know, stay the course long term. And a lot of that conviction comes from a distrust and concern about the pension system we're in, which is something we can get into. Actually, in the grand scheme of things, the pension system we're in is really good, like in terms of how it's funded and the way it's structured. In the state we're in, there's a whole kind of downstate mess that we're technically not a part of. Nonetheless, the way that pensions and defined benefit plans are structured, there's a lot of concerns there for the two of us. And both of us have kind of been beating down this door with our coworkers of like, you need to protect yourself. Like starting saying in the off chance, this thing doesn't come to fruition and provide what you expect for in perpetuity in retirement. Like you need to be, you know, back to freeing up your cash flow, investing on the side, being prepared in case this isn't ready to catch you when you're done as a fireman.
I also think that it's productive to take a longer lens and look at history and understand how empires rise and fall and what kind of season you're in the country you're in during the, you know, and what just generally the season of this empire, if we want to call it that we're in right now. And if you, you know, read a little bit of Dalio, have some understanding of history and you understand how money works and those couple of things, those components put together, when you realize the direction that things are headed in, how completely impotent government agencies are from the smallest level to the completely highest level. And just obviously how corrupt things are in a lot of ways, you can see pretty readily that things aren't going well and they're not getting better. And we're moving much more to a socialist type ideal than a capitalist one, which provided us all the wealth that we have at this time. I think it's pretty apparent to most rational people that things aren't trending in the right direction and you should be protecting yourself with hard assets, as Dan said. Like those are the things that people can't just magically, you know, produce into the world. One of the books that was most influential in my mindset and my understanding of the world is Atlas Shrugged. And looking around the world right now, seeing what's going on, I mean, especially with this trucker thing, like it is like somebody just pulled that world out of that book and produced it into the reality that we're in right now. It's totally crazy.
Yeah. What do you make of what's going on right now in the world? Let's start with the markets. Like, how would you describe what's going on in the markets right now? Just in terms of, yeah, I mean, just sort of the macro view.
complete manipulation, in my opinion. Like, we are so heavily manipulated at this point that the markets and everybody's wealth is completely contingent on the utterings of a group of a few people that run the Federal Reserve in the United States, and ancillarily the ECB and a couple other small central banks in the world. But these people control the price of money and thereby control the happenings in the entire world, you know, indirectly. And that's crazy. That's absolutely crazy.
What do you think? What's the reception from, it's not necessarily the firehouse that you guys are in, but in firehouses, to these kind of conversations? And we talked about two things there that, like, a really high level empires moving more to socialism, and sort of at the lower level, you know, or just at a different plane, the money and what's happening to the money, and markets are rigged and we need to move more to hard assets. Like, I know you guys swing a lot of topics around the firehouse, but like, how are those kind of conversations received? Is it really received as like just more gossip in the air, or is it taken a little bit more to heart? How has your message maybe gotten through? Do they see Bitcoin alongside Ripple still, or?
So I think one nice thing about an environment where you get to know each other intimately is that, yeah, there are some people that probably think Josh and I are clowns, but for most of the people we work with, we have developed a rapport, and they do respect our understanding and grasp of some of these dynamics. So I think most people are truthfully, you know, their ears are perked when the two of us are together, which we're on different shifts, so it doesn't happen all that often, but we're each jabbering in our own house on our own shift all the time. This is true of anybody that you're sort of introducing to this. And Cedric, I'm sure you would agree with this. Like, the longer you're in this space, the more you understand that this is a slow play, that the chances you're going to orange pill someone overnight are almost zero. And so for us, a lot of it is starting just with triggers that people can recognize of why things are artificial. Totally echo what Josh said. I mean, that's how I would define the macro environment, as incredibly frothy and artificial. I said this, we were on Why Are We Bullish with Sessions, BTC Sessions last week. I said this same thing. I think one of the questions I start with right now is asking people, do you have any understanding of why your retirement accounts, whatever investments you have, brokerage accounts, what have you, are at all-time highs during one of the biggest economic crises of the last 100 years? And most people are genuinely confused by that reality. And that's sort of a segue into explaining the dynamics that are at play. In terms of my size up of the market, and this echoes some of what I said last week too, it's just, it makes total sense that the market is reacting the way it is right now. So when they, you know, outlining, when they suppress rates to zero, when they insert all this artificial liquidity through fiscal deficit on fiscal deficit and quantitative easing, those are artificial introductions into the market, right? So when they reverse course on those fronts, right? When they reduce or remove liquidity, and when they act as though they're going to raise rates, it's moving the market closer to reality, which calls the bluff on the existing artificial landscape. And that is how bubbles pop, and that is how the market is reacting. One of the things that I think is most interesting right now, and we covered this with Pish and Foss on our recent episode, you know, Foss outlined the fact that you have the bond market selling off and feeling some pain, at least on many portions of the yield curve, and you have the NASDAQ selling off at the same time. And Pish kind of chimed in after that and said, well, that's because the money's broken. It's a very interesting, precarious dynamic right now. We are in uncharted territory. None of us know where it's going to go. But it's like, where to escape right now? I mean, I guess cash is an answer if you think we're going to continue to be in a crunch. You know, and this is maybe something we'll get into more. I don't want to hog the mic too much on this, but I think there's a lot of reasons Bitcoin is still coupled with risk on assets. So this is a time for people to hang tight and understand that that's kind of one of the consequences of early institutional adoption, is that volatility is an expression of uncertainty. And a lot of people that hold Bitcoin don't know what they have, and they're going to lose it along with other risk assets. So it's an interesting dynamic right now. And which way it's going to go this year, especially if they actually do raise rates, if they actually make a move, if it's more than just pros and it becomes reality, it's going to be fascinating to watch how things proceed.
Right. Before the comment, yeah. Oh, sorry.
I just wanted to comment one more comment on that too, because we had a guy, I mean, he's not so new anymore. He's been on the apartment for about a year, and I was on the ambulance with him one day, and the conversation inevitably ended up on Bitcoin. And I don't know this guy much at all at the time. And I'm explaining to him on the way back from the hospital why he should own some Bitcoin. And so we're going back and forth, and he's asking a lot of the typical questions of people that don't really understand it at all. And he's like, but isn't it just made up money? And I was like, yeah, it absolutely is. But, and I'm reaching here for Sapiens, because this is one of my favorite anecdotes for helping people understand that, yeah, it's made up money, but so is the dollar, and so is the euro. So is every other construct of money, even gold. The only reason gold has any value is because we believe it does. I mean, there's a lot of inherent attributes that it has, but obviously we understand that that's the inherent attributes of money. But the point I was trying to make to him, and the point that delivered this and ended up getting him on board, was these are all fictions. All of these things, everything we do, everything humans do on top of like eating and our typical bodily necessities are all fictions. We all believe that this fire department is real, and we all believe that we have to go on this ambulance call to go help this old lady or whatever. We all believe that Facebook is a company and we use their product. We all believe the dollar is money. And if we believe that Bitcoin is money, then it becomes money. And it has the attributes that are far superior to any other money that's ever existed. And thereby, it will outcompete other forms of money in the long run. And he got it almost immediately. I was actually really proud of that moment. I was like, damn, that's the way I'm presenting this from now on.
Cedric, I actually, on that note, I think it's a kind of a question for you, and that's you've got a deep finance background and you've worked in that arena for a long time. There's sort of something interesting. I remember this story by Croesus. I don't know if you know who Croesus is on Twitter.
I was just listening to him on your show.
Yeah, fantastic discussion with him. And he was saying that one of the people that got Bitcoin the quickest and earliest in his circle was just this guy that he knows that runs a sailboat. Like this guy, smart dude, like decent first principle thinker, and is able to kind of put these pieces together, maybe even before, you know, the yuppie elite, as he calls them. I'm also actually reading Andy Edstrom's book, Why Buy Bitcoin, right now. And he says in the beginning, it took him like 15 years to understand what money was, even working in professional finance. You have any of those, like, did you get this early on in your career, or did you have any of these experiences of like, holy shit, I've been swimming in the water for X number of years and I didn't even know what the substance was around me?
Yeah. I mean, I definitely think there's a lot of that. A lot of people are very focused on their niche, which in whatever industry they are, even in accounting or finance or consulting. Something that's also, I ponder a lot is, I don't really like to think about people as blue collar or white collar. A lot of times what I find is, especially in if someone has a typical blue collar job, whatever that means or entails, they might have a white collar background. They might have a white collar education. They might have studied, you know, not studied. They've mastered things maybe outside of that industry as well. And but I do find that it's possible that maybe people in blue collar fields get Bitcoin maybe a little bit quicker, because there's more proof of work and more skin in the game, and I think that they're maybe further from the money spigot in just a lot of different ways. I think totally. That a lot of conviction in what you're doing or how you think or what you know you don't know what you don't know comes from being educated in a certain area and feeling that you do know, and I find that a lot of people are very reluctant to maybe acknowledge that somebody else playing in the same field knows something that they don't know, or is telling them something new. I think that's where a lot of people, they think, oh, okay, well, you're telling me about this new made up money. Well, you probably didn't find the one that's going to be perfect, or you struck your lottery ticket, so I'm going to go find mine. You probably haven't found the world's next reserve currency. But, you know, if yours has a shot, maybe I'll find something else that has a shot at that. Maybe you have, you got in earlier than me, so I don't want to chase you. It's sort of that fiat mindset.
But it's also very hard to convince them that there's anything new under the sun. I in a lot of ways, one of the reasons I started the podcast, one of the many reasons was I didn't want to talk to people about work about it anymore. They weren't receiving it well. They didn't see it as anything new or different. And one of the things that like, one of the ways that I kind of question for you guys is around pensions, right? And this notion of money and whether money is made up or whether money is going to be good in the future, and not even just pensions, but salaries. So maybe you work your whole life, you know, at a fire department. You guys use an interesting word, agency. So maybe you can explain what that is. But, you know, you, in my thinking of the system is you work at state-sponsored fire department, and at the end of X amount of years, you're going to get a state pension. And that's sort of a promise or a guarantee, and there's a bucket of money, and then they have to go out and achieve their goals. But we don't know if that money will be enough in the future to pay out the pension. And we don't even know if the money will be good.
Right.
And I wonder if the conversation, you know, gets sort of, and the reason I, you know, I think there's blue collar and white collar, but even in sort of this first responders, when, you know, especially even maybe like if you include law enforcement, the military, of course, I don't envision people risking their lives for money that's not good. And, yeah. And at some point there's a calculation where, you know, people have to make a decision, especially around like maybe moving or staying in a certain state, a state tied pension maybe, and giving up sort of, you know, 12 years here or 20 years there, and you're on your way to something. But on the other hand, you might have to work another 8 or 10 years and the money might not be there, or the structure might be different, or the guarantee or the promises might be different. Do those conversations come up? Do are people looking at it from that level?
I don't think most people look very deeply into it. The guys we work with, well-intentioned, like most guys are not very interested in the world of finance, honestly. Like, I think the background that you were steeped in, or you were with people that were, you know, CPAs and like people that are financially literate on a different level, like went to school for it. That's a entirely different world from where we reside. And this isn't to degrade anybody that we work with. And if any one of those guys is listening, that certainly isn't my intention, but it's just it's a matter of interest, you know, like I don't really watch football. And if someone's having a conversation about football, like I know I'm out, like it's a total
pointless. Josh is a complete loser, Cedric. That's
I don't watch it. Total loser. I don't even know who Tom Brady is or how many years he's played or whatever he did last Sunday. I don't care. The point I'm trying to make is it's just a matter of interest. Like, it's not about intelligence. It's about what are you interested in? And I just happen to be interested in finance, and I've gone down this rabbit hole. And so as far as the questions that you were asking about, like defined benefit plans in Illinois, a lot of changes have happened in the last year, especially for us, because we used to have municipally funded pensions that were all individual. I am a pension board member at the agency that we work at, and the state of Illinois changed the law, and they just conglomerated all of these pensions, around 400 of them, into one giant pot of money. And I can see the look on your face. Like, so the state of Illinois taking ownership of billions of our dollars, promising us to pay, you know, our pension benefits in 20 to 30 years. And then hopefully hanging on to that for another 20 or 30 years before we kick the bucket. I don't have a high degree of confidence in that personally. Yeah. And I want to run these numbers by you. I don't know if you got to listen to us with Foss and Pish, but there's two assumptions built into this plan that has a lot to do with the, you know, percentage funded. And two of these assumptions are that there's going to be 2.25% interest, or not, I'm sorry, 2.25% inflation in perpetuity. That's number one. That's a huge fly in the ointment if you have any idea what's going on right now. The other assumption is 7.1% return on average for the next, you know, into perpetuity. So those two numbers build this entire thing. That's the core of the idea that this is actually funded. And by the way, there's 30% of that invested in fixed income. So you've got 30% fixed income with those assumptions as your baseline. And sure, there's a lot of money in there, but exactly to your point, like what is that money going to be worth in 20 or 30 years, if anything at all? And, you know, if it is worth something, hopefully Illinois hasn't pilfered the entire thing.
I have a few
existential threats there.
I have a few comments. So Josh and I toe this line of wanting to be realists and wanting people to protect themselves, but also not doing the whole Chicken Little sky is falling kind of thing. The pension situation in this state, and I'm sure it's this way across the country, is actually quite complex. There's more than meets the eye. Like, there are some holes in some things I'm going to say here. And if you play out future scenarios, they may disappear. But like, our pension is completely dissimilar from like the teacher's pension in the state. It's not funded by the state of Illinois. It's funded by the individual municipalities. Okay. So there are numerous pensions that are funded by municipalities. Another one is IMRF, which is for municipal employees. And like, our pension and that pension are, by actuarial standards today, actually very well funded. And so very different than the downstate pensions in this state that that are in dire straits. Okay. The issue though, that confronts all pensions, is that politicians hold leverage over the coffers, right? And so what was just demonstrated and Josh highlighted a second ago is that if they can tell you to move money here or there, like when things get precarious in the future, obviously we're one bill away from everything being together and it being a problem, right? So this is actually, and this is going a little bit far down the rabbit hole, but I think one thing that's kind of interesting for us as firemen is like, history shows us pensions generally don't work. They're incredibly expensive. They're unsustainable. The word Ponzi scheme comes out all the time. And I know there's a lot of Bitcoin plebs that probably feel that way. And we totally understand, you know what I mean? We have incentives based on where we work to have this thing proliferate. I do think an argument can be made that like, what we do for a living is unique in that, you know, and not that this happens all the time, but if you're house is on fire and you want us to risk our life, we have families too, to go up to your second story to grab your daughter. Like, there's a little bit more at stake for the line of work we have. So I think as the future carries on, it's not that we want everybody else to drown, but it's like, it's our goal to keep the firefighter pension in this state solvent. Right. And so this gets to performance, because this is something else we say to our coworkers. It's like, you can be promised all the dough you want. If the math doesn't work, the math doesn't work. As I say, it either performs or it perishes. And so this is where the two of us are at least wanting to start the conversation. We don't have lofty expectations on where this goes. We're actually quite pessimistic, but we at least want to do our part to start the conversation and follow in the footsteps of like Houston Firefighters Pension, that took a position in Bitcoin last year, and say, hey, this might be the buoy that keeps this ship afloat long term. And taking, you know, a 1-3-5% hedge position in Bitcoin could be a huge deal for long term solvency for both the people that are working and our retirees that have done a full career. Because what's at stake is significant. I mean, there's a lot of people that have been promised this for a long time that don't have another plan. So I think there's sort of like dual priorities. Do our best to keep this thing solvent long term, but also help train and encourage existing firefighters to protect themselves in case it's not there in the future.
Yeah, definitely a lot to unpack there. You know, pensions are an interesting thing. My parents were both public school teachers in New York City for decades. They live off their pensions now. I see how remarkable that has been, you know, for the boomers and their generation. You know, the numbers that Josh threw out there are sort of kind of clownish. Inflation of 2% and, you know, return of 7%. And well, I can see that, you know, and I have a brother-in-law who works for the state, a department of the state here in Illinois, and has got a pension-based future. And I have another brother-in-law who's a firefighter in Illinois. And, you know, I think that everyone's getting squeezed on so many fronts. I think this is maybe Dan who said this, but you know, everyone's over expanding in terms of how much you can spend. People have no free cash flow, a salary with a very hard ceiling in an inflationary environment. And that's where Dan and Josh are coming in with the lifeboat screaming at the Titanic. And, you know, and I think, you know, we're coming up on maybe what could be a historical crunch in terms of inflation and purchasing power for a lot of people who are on sort of a salary-based cost of living increase, or but just long term, you know, I remember growing up, the fire department, I used to come door to door to raise funds. And my father gave every single time. He was very concerned that he was going to be put on some list and they weren't going to come to his house if he didn't give.
And push out a little later.
The recommendation. Boys, yeah.
I can promise you that doesn't happen. We've gone to one lady's house like literally 80 times this last year. So,
right. But my and I said to him, there's no list, but you know, he's like, well, why take the karmic chance? But
hey, boys, take your time. We're going to 28 Elm Street. All right. Slow it down. Yeah.
But, you know, I think, you know, in the, you know, the subconscious of the mind, whether at some point, if you're not getting paid, you're not doing your work. If the money doesn't work, if the pension doesn't come through, you know, I would like to ask you guys then, just in terms of whether it's the pension or for families, how would you guys, you know, build a portfolio for the next 15 or 20 years?
Dan, you can go ahead first on that one.
Before I do, I want to say one thing. I think you've highlighted this a couple times, Cedric, and it's totally true. We do live and work in the demographic that feels the pain right now. You know, I mean, Josh and I talk frequently. It's different right now for new hires. Even, you know, I've only been on 5 years, but guys coming in behind me, it's different. We both own homes a lot. You know, most people that start in the fire service don't. And like, even just taking that case study, you know, off our salary, buying a decent house is getting harder and harder and harder. We used to put in $15 a day for meals. Now it's basically always 20. I mean, we're in an earning capacity that 7% inflation is going to be a problem. I mean, obviously eventually wages will move up, but it's going to be a massive lagging indicator. It's not going to be anywhere close to keep up with it if it's a worse or bad scenario. And so, I know there's a lot of people listening that are in that boat, but if you are in a totally different income stream and you have a lot of extra to work with, you may not be feeling the pressures right now that we and our coworkers feel. In terms of how to compose a portfolio, it's getting increasingly tough to give advice on this front.
Mm-hmm. And none of this is financial advice.
Yeah, no. Yeah, for sure. But I would say like what's non-negotiable right now is Bitcoin. Like, I think we would both agree that the non-negotiable position is Bitcoin. And I do think that for most people that needs to start small, because if you don't have the conviction and understanding, you're not going to do yourself a favor, right? When we have a 50% drawdown like we're experiencing right now, you're not going to hold on if you don't have the discipline. So owning a little bit gets you on the learning journey. And then that usually devolves into possessing more Bitcoin. In terms of don't own bonds. I mean, this is another classic and everybody's heard this in the Bitcoin space, but don't own any fixed income. I still own a lot of indexed equity. I mean, I think I still have a lot of those convictions I highlighted earlier in the show, which is that, sure, is there a lot of froth in equity and in the, absolutely there is. But I sort of have, you know, between index funds and some mutual funds that I've researched and selected, that's where a lot of my retirement money is headed. In the short run right now, I think GBTC for people that aren't willing to possess bearer Bitcoin, like our first suggestion is, you know, buy bearer Bitcoin and cold store it. Absolutely. But for a lot of noobs that want a bigger position or that don't want to cash out of a 401k or in our case, a 457, and now most 457s aren't going to have access to this fund, but GBTC is tantalizing right now. It's 30% below NAV. If you play out the future, it's hard to imagine that Grayscale, who possesses more Bitcoin than anyone in the world, is not going to get a spot ETF. So I'm hearkening back to people like Dr. Jeff Ross and Joe Carlisare, who agree that this is on a DCA basis over the next, say, 3 to 5 years. I think GBTC is a good buy, and I have purchased quite a bit of that in Roth IRAs, and my wife has a 401k. She's a nurse. Those are some of my thoughts.
Yeah, I hate recommending. I mean, I think we all understand that when you tell people what to buy, like as you said, Dan, the convictions, if they're not there, it's just a losing battle because they're going to panic sell and they're not going to understand, not be able to weather the storm. I think number one, you need to be educated on what it is you're buying in every avenue, whether that's equities, whether that's, you know, Bitcoin, whether that's commodities, whatever it is you want to own. But I think commodities should play a decent role in someone's portfolio right now, even if it's as simple as positioning yourself with a good chunk of commodity indexes that'll allow you to have some position on hard assets that will, you know, at least rise to equate with inflation, if not beat it a little bit. As much Bitcoin as you can muster, like with, you know, you have to kind of measure yourself. You have to know, how much do I think this is going to work? How much can I weather the storm? And yeah, just your own ability to sleep at night while your portfolio is down 50%. Like if you can do that and you know you can do that, then do it. Go, you know, go hog wild. I still think that having some small allocation to precious metals is a good idea. I'm a classic gold bug for a long, long time. I've got very little these days, but still think Peter Schiff's got a bit of a point, not on Bitcoin, but on gold. He's clearly lost his mind in terms of Bitcoin. And I do think there's a place for equities, even though in the short term, they're probably going to get slaughtered. And I would resonate completely with Dan. Like if you own fixed income, you're agreeing to a contract where you're guaranteed to lose money. That is a horrible idea. REITs are also probably not a bad idea right now because, owning some, you know, some property is a good thing as long as you don't have to manage tenants, because that sucks. I've done that. Yeah. But good luck figuring out what percentages that's a very personal kind of thing that you have to figure out on your own and be ready for volatility. And yeah. I think right now having a cash position is probably not a bad idea because there's a very good chance the Fed will at least go through with one tightening scenario and they'll probably get burnt really bad. And it'll be a good time to score some really cheap commodities. Maybe. Yeah. I'm sure everything's going to shit the bed when that happens. So buy it all when it shits the bed, especially Bitcoin.
Right.
The thing about the one thing I would say about a cash position is that I'm not saying that's a bad idea at all, especially if we're in a credit crunch and things are kind of devolving the way they are right now. But that does sort of assume that you are doing some trading and timing markets, which
right,
for the well-trained could make sense. But for the average, you know, blue collar, middle class or non-financially educated individual, that's not a good idea. And that's where I think we would both agree, Josh, that for most individuals, setting a strategy that you DCA into across all fronts, Bitcoin, yeah, commodities, equity, whatever you decide to have in there, a set and forget long-term strategy is going to serve you well. I think more than trying to time and hop in and out of markets.
Yep, I agree. I always advocate for that, but I'm guilty of trying to play games as well. And I win probably just as much as I lose. So, you know, take that for what it's worth. Like it is what it is. Fed might back off and we might actually see this thing just go rocketing back right off. There's no way to tell. There's just
risk of holding cash. Lawrence Lepard came on our show a couple months ago. I think he made a really good point. I love his honesty of gold versus Bitcoin. So basically his thesis is this. He's like, everybody chill out. Bitcoin is far superior across most of the properties. Okay. And long term, he sees the market cap of Bitcoin far exceeding gold. But his point is like, hey, we're really early in the adoption curve. And in the environment we're in at the end of a long-term debt cycle, where we're likely going to experience significant debasement and inflation the way we did in the 70s up till say 81, hard money is going to do really well over the next 10, 15 years, you know? And so to assume that's all going to flow into Bitcoin, I do agree with him, is naive. You know, you have an entire boomer generation that is just not going to onboard to this, or at least it's not going to be their sole hard asset possession. So I think this is basically the math he outlined. He said that, you know, in that inflationary push in the 70s up to the early 80s, gold rose to 7% of global assets. Okay. Mm. Which in today's dollars would be $35 trillion. Okay. And then he goes back to the existing market caps and he says, Bitcoin's at 1 trillion or less than that. And actual tradable gold, he highlights, is around, I think he says around 5 trillion. So he's like, we're at 6 trillion of hard money assets. If we even just go back to where we were in the late 70s, early 80s, we're at 35 trillion. So that's kind of his low mark, because he views the event we're about to experience as far more significant than the inflation we experienced, or the environment that we experienced in the 70s and 80s. And his point is, like, as we, if you take that $35 trillion number, if you think that's all going into Bitcoin, you know, the word is naive there. Some of that is going to flow into gold. And I do think it's going to do well, one could say, in the midterm. So I don't necessarily think gold is a bad position. I just can't, get myself to click buy on gold when I can also click buy on Bitcoin. Like, that's me personally, but I totally understand if somebody has a gold position. And I don't anymore, but I had a gold position for like 6 years. So I respect it. I understand it. And I think he provides a really nuanced, balanced view. Lawrence Lepard does.
When you say gold position, I'm assuming you mean an ETF.
I think it could be either. Josh, I've only owned an ETF, but Josh, you've possessed physical gold, right?
Yeah, I had physical for a while. That's a story in and of itself, trying to sell that back to the exchange because it got lost in the mail.
Oh, my nightmare.
It was a total nightmare. I was shitting my pants for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Can we hear a year?
Way easier to sell.
Yeah.
Yeah, just on so many fronts. And just that whole recognition, I never could take a large custodianship of my wealth in gold. You know, I think that's just really hard to do as an individual. One thing I'm kind of curious, on a personal level. So as your conviction and understanding in Bitcoin has grown, and if you're on any sort of DCA plan, your allocation is growing alongside maybe the purchasing power of the Bitcoin through the years. How do you maybe deal with your families or your wives and explain, like, I'm putting my money in this thing, our money in this thing that, you know, I or we or everyone doesn't understand yet, you know, and how deep in the weeds do you get on this kind of subject?
It's really dependent on the person, you know. Like, I think everyone's experienced this. There's some people that are very receptive to understanding and want to know more. There's most people who they don't want to know about it until it really matters, you know, to them, because they own it, which is why the best way to get someone to learn about Bitcoin is to get them to buy some, because now they're going to be incentivized to go out and actually learn about it a little bit. And then, you know, down that rabbit hole they go, and pretty soon they have a substantial amount in terms of what their assets are. But I mean, I know personally, my wife she probably watches the price of Bitcoin more than I do. And she's ruthless about it. Like, I'm like, I don't even want to know. Don't tell me what it is today. I don't want to hear about it. But, and she does it mostly in jest, but I think maybe secretly she's serious.
Mm-hmm. She's dead serious.
Yeah.
Inheritance planning is a huge, huge deal. And I don't think this gets talked about enough. You know, you see a lot of people on Twitter talking about setting up multi-sigs and all these complex self-custody schemas, which are really cool. And the fact that they exist and they're a possibility is one of the, you know, amazing parts of this protocol. But you just constantly have to ask yourself the question, if I have a heart attack right now, or I don't come back from work, or I get in a car accident tomorrow and I disappear, who's getting my Bitcoin? And if you're not 100% confident that it's going to get into the right hands, that's a problem. And I think it needs to go even further than you individually. Like, so my wife and I have gone the step two, which is like, what if we're both on a plane or both in a car and we both pass away? Like, are our kids going to get this money? Have to be able to answer these questions. And that goes back to, you cannot get out over your skis. I actually had somebody over at my house 2 days ago, and I was just walking through. We were talking about cold storage solutions and how this all works and moving Bitcoin, kind of like introductory stuff. And he's like, I kind of want to just leave it where it is. It's cold stored already, you know, in single sig for this person. He's like, I just don't feel ready. I'm like, then pump the freaking brakes, you know, don't move it to a new device or whatever until you feel completely ready. Start with a small amount of money on that new device or in that new setup, explore, move money incessantly until you're 100% confident it works, until you know your spouse understands it, until you know someone's going to definitely get a hold of it if something happens. I am growing increasingly interested in the Casa Unchained products. So I have an Unchained Cap vault that I opened. I did it myself with two devices. I know that this is controversial in some people's minds because obviously there's a centralized point that knows how much Bitcoin you have. I think my response to that is you don't have to put your whole stack there. And I think these solutions are just phenomenal from an inheritance planning standpoint. Like literally you can tell your spouse or your brother or whoever, all they need to do is find one of four things, right? Two devices, two backups. They need to find one of four things and call Unchained Capital and they have access to your Bitcoin. That this them holding one of three keys or one of, you know, two of five or whatever setup you have, it's a really good solution. I think there's going to be a lot of demand for it. And like for people that want to move it off an exchange, but don't want to have all the onus on themselves, I think these solutions can make a lot of sense for at least a portion of someone's stack.
Yeah. Those are great points. And, yeah, and I think really hard for a lot of people to grapple with was as we, you know, deal and reckon with this new protocol and how to take self-sovereignty over our value and our wealth and our time. You know, and it's almost it's a pleasant Pandora's box. But, you know, with any sort of responsibility and ownership comes accountability. And yeah, it's wild stuff. And I'm kind of curious then, and I think that this was Dan who might have said this, but how is Bitcoin like a slippery hog?
That's been a main theme. That
Josh is actually he's the one that likes that. He's the one that got me into hogs. Josh,
I'm not sure that's true, Dan. I think maybe you came up with that, but either way, it doesn't really matter. I think the anecdote is just. Was that Croesus where we came up with that? I don't know who it was. But anyway, like I'm just imagining when I think of those two words in conjunction, I'm thinking like, good luck riding, you know, like this giant hog is just covered in KY jelly and you've got to grab onto this thing and hold on for dear life. If you can grab it, that's what it's like owning Bitcoin over any period of time. Like you're constantly in an emotional roller coaster. You know, at least until you reach like Bitcoin Zen position, which I don't think many people are in, but you're up and down all the time, like holding on to this thing and just not having any idea where she's going tomorrow and which direction she's going to throw you for. It's both incredibly engaging and scary at the same time because we just don't know. I mean, in the long term, I think we're pretty confident because the game theoretics that are involved here, I mean, it's pretty apparent when you just watch the politicians getting involved in this thing. Now, half of them have no clue what they're even talking about. They just know like I'm going to get engagement on Twitter if I start spouting off about Bitcoin, and they're right. And just the fact that they understand that at this point is incredibly encouraging because it signifies that there's enough voting block for this, that they want to have Bitcoin associated with their name because it's an easy win. So that slippery hog, it's hard to ride.
I think slippery hog has like morphed through the episodes, Cedric. So I think, and maybe we have some diehard fan that can tell us the origins of slippery hog. I don't even know which episode it came in on, but I think maybe the first time we talked about it, it was in the regulatory political context of like, if you think you're going to be able to regulate this and get your hands around it, like good fucking luck, because this thing can spin move out of any double team on the floor. I mean, it is, when you think about it being inherently global and censorship resistant and permissionless, the implications of this reality are truly mind blowing. I think the sovereign individual really kind of made me understand what we're dealing with here. If you've never read The Sovereign Individual, it is dry. It is long to get through, but it's worth reading. You kind of realize what the implications of cryptography and digital value are in the future. And I do think, you know, this is where playing the long game is important. Like, absolutely. If a huge Western nation outlaws this thing, which I think is growing increasingly unrealistic. That's a different topic. But if that were to happen, I bet my bottom dollar that short and midterm, the price is selling off. But that doesn't mean this thing's not going to proliferate over decades. I mean, it's just going to flow to the low ground. Somebody's going to pick it up. I mean, you look at the El Salvadors of the world, like you're going to be able to remember 12 words and move somewhere. And not that we're encouraging people to obfuscate, you know, the IRS, but like this thing is almost impossible to track, at least if you're doing a lot of, you know, tricks of the trade. So it's a totally new animal. And we've chosen to use the phrase slippery hog to describe it, along with many other animal analogies in our show.
But there's three reference points for this, you know, just in the last year or so. Like China, they banned mining and it kicked this thing right in the dick for like 3 months. That slippery hog slid away and the hash power is back where it wasn't above that. Russia came out and said they were going to potentially ban it. Their central bank said that. And then Russia spin moves and says, oh, actually, we own $200 billion worth of, you know, I don't know if they said Bitcoin specifically, but crypto. And then India, who's been on and off again saying they're going to ban this. And now they're just like, oh, I guess we're just going to regulate it. Like this game theory is just marvelous. It's amazing. Yeah.
And then so it's interesting to watch like Gary Gensler, right, of the SEC kind of categorize this in its own very unique space. Like at this point, he's been very honest and clear that he sees Bitcoin in its own camp and then every other coin in another. And like, maybe that's because he likes it and understands it, but it's also because he knows like there's no possible way to get your arms around this thing. Like the other coins, you can get your arms around because there's some, at least some centralized entity you can go after. Going after this protocol, he's smart enough to understand it's nearly impossible. And I think time will show that that's the case.
Yeah. I was really enjoying the show with Pish and Foss. And one of the points that you guys seem to really agree on was that, you know, Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger, while great value investors of the past, they're really pulling forward benefits at the expense of our kids right now. And you know, it's one thing, you know, one thing I can imagine being really hard is to advocate for sort of portfolio structure change at you, whoever's managing all these pensions. And that's just going to play out very slowly, maybe. Not everyone's going to jump on board like Houston, or maybe that's really frustrating. But I'm really curious, how do you guys see this playing out over the next 5 or 10 years? QE forever, COVID, the Fed, these narratives, trust in the old system, kind of getting back to what Josh brought up at the beginning of the show, just around these larger macro issues in the world. How do you see this playing out?
I'll take this one first, Dan. I think the way this is going to probably play out, the best way to approach it is to kind of look at the past and see how this has played out in other places throughout time. Because this is not a new situation. This is a situation that has played out through many countries and many times and many places. It's just a, you know, like saying modern monetary theory is modern is anything, you know, that's anything but true. Like that is the exact same playbook that every country that has destroyed its money ends up having to play out. So, and then you see all this populism that goes on. And this is very similar and echoes of like the 30s. And 20s and 30s in America, when we had the Great Depression and people were fed up and pissed and they vote for the populist politicians that tell them whatever. And people generally just vote for whoever tells them what they want to hear. But I think the general mood is fairly dark. I mean, see, like we see all these riots in the last couple of years. You see people just generally depressed and people know there's something wrong, but they don't know exactly what. And yet the bread and circus, kind of the Roman Empire idea, continues. I think people are losing faith in institutions generally. I think if you've read the book, The Fourth Turning, what's going on right now echoes very and resonates exactly like how that book described, which is that institutions generally are built during the first part of the, you know, process of this fourth generation cycle. And these all institutions were generally built in the early 20th century. They have played their role they are coming to the end of their usefulness. They are now old, rotten, and corrupt, arguably. And I think they're likely to get bypassed by new institutions. And I hope that that happens softly. I hope it happens peacefully. But generally, through history, that is not really the way these things tend to work. Usually, it's pretty volatile. So I hope for everyone's sake that it is an easy transition into something better. And I think Bitcoin is an instance of a way for this to transition peacefully. Because it really is, as we've said a bunch of times, that this is a parallel system being built next to a rotting system that we can transition to, I mean, fairly easily. The rails have already been built between the two systems.
Yeah.
And we just need to transition over. And we can avoid so much cataclysm by allowing that to happen.
Yeah.
The way I see it, so my base case for the next decade is that inflation is insidious, is the word I would use. I would say my expectation is like 4 to 8% year over year. We'll call it CPI, which we know is a blunt tool, but it's maybe the best in existence. To trend year over year, I think people are going to look back in 2030 very differently than they look back at 2020. I think this decade, buying power is going to diminish significantly if you're not holding the right chess pieces. I think that the market, and these are not out there claims, I think we're going to have more frequent and dramatic fits in the market. I think you're going to see massive sell-offs, significant balloons, and it's going to be obviously propped up by tremendous amounts of inserted liquidity. I think we're moving towards things like yield curve control, where they're going to take complete control of or across the entire yield curve to keep rates down. I think they're probably going to end up stepping in to buy things like equity, like Japanification. I think they're going to kind of do everything to keep the system afloat, which, like, in fairness to them, I understand. Like, they're trying to keep people out of the streets and from resorting to things that none of us would want. Like, they're trying to hold this system together as we are at the end of a long-term debt cycle. Now, I said that's my base case. I can envision a scenario where we have a just massively uncontrolled deflationary event, like say the 1930s, and we experience something really ugly for a period of 2 or 3 years, and then hopefully come out on the other side. I guess my hope is that that doesn't happen. And I tend to think they'll kind of be able to walk the tightrope for a while and play the games and sort of keep things together. And people won't really notice or be able to notice as keenly as they should their buying power being stolen. In terms of Bitcoin, man, does Bitcoin present an interesting gorilla in the ring, because, and this is where it gets a little scary, because you can totally see Bitcoiners being labeled as villains. Like, there's this assumption, right? If you're the Federal Reserve and you work in traditional finance, that the water's trapped in this pool, right? And it's going nowhere. The water's getting muddy and disgusting, but it's trapped in this pool. And I think a lot of people aren't noticing that there's this large plug on the side of the pool that's cracked open right now. And if it gets pulled completely, a lot of the water in that pool could get loosed into the lawn next to it, right? And I think it's kind of scary to think about the implications for Bitcoin. I just don't think humanity has conceptualized what totally fixed algorithmic inelastic supply means. And I think when the demand at the orders of magnitude I envision enters this market, I think some of the moves you're going to see in price over the next 10 years are going to melt fucking faces. I think people are going to be, the word is going to be confused. There's going to be a lot of people on a lot of trading desks that don't understand how the price can move as quickly and as fast as it can. And it's because it's nothing any human being has ever seen. We've never been up against a completely brick wall in a market like this. And I think it's going to get pretty weird. I agree with Josh though. Like, I'm not going to celebrate these cataclysmic events. Like, I hope Foss is right, that we can transition gently. But yeah, I agree with Preston Pish when he says, like, I think there's a chance that over the next 10, 20 years, a 1% position in Bitcoin could keep your entire buying power intact. Like, that's how significant I think the increases in valuation are going to be of this network.
When you think about those things, like just those, it's like a giant windstorm. It's it's either put up your sail and go with the wind, or, you know, are you going to try to tack against this storm? Like, no. And we've got the most pristine, beautiful sailing ship that's ever been built. That's Bitcoin. And it's hard to imagine how this asset isn't going to appreciate massively over the next 10 to 20 years in the environment that it's in. This what it was built for.
This is the most simple, like, argument I can make. So the supply side's completely out of the equation, which is super unique with this asset. I mean, even with something like gold, the supply side's still in play. Like, as you look at the stock flow model, but in Bitcoin, the supply side is totally off the table. It's not even a variable. We know it, right? So if you're a long-term Bitcoin bear, you have to explain how demand for the world's first completely fixed, inherently digital, global, open source, programmable, so improvable, instantly transferable asset, like all these incredibly unique characteristics, how demand for this unbelievable new innovation that's showing tremendous promise, right, across the globe from, top to bottom. You have to argue and explain how demand for that is going to go down over the next 10 years. And my response is good fucking luck. I do not see that happening. And so even if you think demand's going to stay the same as it is in the year 2022, the price is going way up. You know what I mean? As the noose gets tightened on supply.
Yeah. I love the way you guys think about Bitcoin. And I'm really curious. Let's say that I'm kind of curious where you guys want to be in 20 or 30 years. And what I mean by that, though, is not based on what Bitcoin's going to do, but like if Bitcoin didn't exist, you're going to work at the firehouse for 20 or 30 years. What were your goals and dreams before that? And in a world where Bitcoin does exist, what percentage of firefighters do you think have a chance of achieving that goal without Bitcoin? Or goal like that. Obviously, you all have different goals.
Yeah. So personally, and this may come as a surprise, like I'm not super money driven. If I was, I wouldn't be a fireman. It's not that I don't like money and I don't, but my main motivation for being, engaging the world of finance and investing is just to be responsible, right? And to make sure my family's taken care of. I have some other examples in my life of some people close to me that have run into some trouble, and that's formed a lot of the way I look at money and plan for the future.
Well, let's say money worked. It just works. You don't even have to, like, right. You're like, okay, you want to go play in the equity casino, good on you, but your money is good. You go to work and you're going to get the deal you were promised as long as you show up.
Yeah.
And so then you're at the kind end of a certain like, period of time, is it move wherever the kids go to college? Is it move to Florida? Is it, retire? Is it become a firefighter instructor or do something entrepreneurial with firefighting? Is it like, what would be the sort of the end goal of I've done the career now?
Yeah.
What am I going to do after my career?
Yeah. Have optionality would be the first statement, like be in a position where I can make that choice. I'm a dad and a husband, spend a ton of time with my family. Have time and health and energy to continue exploring and learning. I love golf. So, I play a lot of golf still, but I envision, throughout my career, but also as things unwind, enjoying the game of golf, having time to be outside, travel and explore. My wife and I love the national parks. I've been to Yosemite like 6 times. So just being in a position to have the optionality to continue to soak in what life has to offer, because time and Bitcoin are the two completely scarce things in the world. And I want to enjoy and the time I have here, both for myself, but also hopefully bless the people around me.
Do you think you'll be in the same neck of the woods and hopefully your children will grow up in the same neck of the woods and start their lives and families?
I'll say this and then I'll pass it to Josh. I actually don't mind the Midwest, which may come as a surprise to some people. Like I actually enjoy the winter. Like I love the summer, but I also love 12-inch snowfalls. So I don't think it's something like, oh, I have to get out of Dodge. But there's a lot of other parts of this country that intrigue me. I mean, Colorado is kind of at the top of the list. I love skiing. It's one of my favorite things to do. We actually have an annual department ski trip. Just got back from that. Usually 10 or so guys go. So like, yeah, I mean, that's a possibility, but it's not as though I'm averse to the area I'm in right now. I'm fine being in this area.
Nice. Josh?
Yeah, I think I would call myself, as Robert Breedlove does, a freedom maximalist. And I want to do whatever I can to increase my ability to have as much freedom as I can in just about every avenue, including my free time. So, you know, I, to be totally honest, like I haven't really fleshed out like where I want to actually be but I think the priority number one is like be well off enough to have optionality, like Dan said, be able to go where I want, you know, when I want, be able to be around my kids and grandkids, hopefully be able to, spoil them, you know, be well off enough. I mean, I'm not also super money driven where I want to be ultra wealthy. Otherwise I probably would have also chosen another career path, but we do well enough and, you know, it's a good living and we have free time that avails us to doing things that
have podcasts,
like have a podcast or like with another fireman at the same department, I have a small business that we run together. Just having the ability to be entrepreneurial while at the same time having the backstop of a salary so that like, if it all blows up in my face, I still have, you know, I still can fall back in the position, where I'm not going to starve. And that's a really good place to be as an entrepreneur where you don't have to worry about failing so much, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I find that firefighters are some of the smartest people I've ever met. And somehow I think it's more about a calling or in a lifestyle than anything else I've seemed to find. But yeah,
I think it's also problem solving.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if I was to kind of like, you know, puff up the ego of a fireman, I would say we just respond to all kinds of crazy shit. Like we are the last resort in town. Like if something insane is happening with your sump pump, like guess who's figuring it out? It's us. You know what I mean? Right. So it's medical, it's fire, but it's any problem that happens in a house that a cop can't figure out, which they can't figure out much. So
yeah.
They're usually calling the fire department and it's just five dudes sitting in a basement knee deep in water, trying to figure out what the heck's going on in your house. So, yeah, you know, I think that is, at least from the background I come from, like that it's really stretched me and I think it's improved me as a person. Just like, you know, you can take it away from the firehouse. You just become a problem solver, a fixer, because anytime someone calls 911, you're fixing the problem.
Yeah. My brother-in-law, he was an engineer before he became a firefighter. He just didn't like sitting at a desk. Super smart guy, very resourceful, one of the most handiest, intelligent people I've ever met. And it's also interesting how I think firefighters are just received differently than police and law enforcement. You know, I've kind of gotten to the notion where if I tell my kids, if you're ever in trouble, if you're ever lost, you ever need to help, like find a mom.
You know? find a mom.
Yeah. Like that's going to be safe. And they're like, and I'm like, don't go to the cops. Because the first thing the cops are going to be like, why'd you lose your son or daughter? You know, and it's gonna be a problem. And they're going to want to enforce some sort of rule maybe, but I'm just like, find a mom. But
policing's complicated in that, like, this is true of firemen too. Like there's a ton of jag off firemen and there's a ton of jag off cops. There's a bunch of great firefighters and there's a bunch of great cops. Sure. I think we both agree, like there's issues that need to be solved and incentives may be awry in certain areas. I would say like we run with the police a ton. I think we're lucky to be in a town where we have a great relationship with our police. They're super well trained. They're well vetted. The backgrounds are robust. You know, it's kind of like a really, really good environment compared to the rest of the country. And I do think the job like, I totally understand where you're coming from. I think the job is also a lot more complex than most people realize, in that, like, hindsight's just 20/20. I mean, even as a paramedic, like, some of the environments we're in with, say, psych patients, they're downright scary. I mean, when you have a, you know, psychotic or, you know, overdosed 230-pound dude, you know, it's freaking scary. It's fluid, and wanting to make sure things end up okay. So, yeah, I think there's a complexity there that I think it's nice that we get to kind of see that. I mean, we don't understand their job. We do a completely different job, and we're actually wound totally differently. Like, firemen are pack animals and cops are lone wolf type personalities. That's a huge generalization, but
yeah, I agree with that.
By and large, that's totally, totally accurate.
That's so interesting. Super cool. Guys, I love your energy and the rapport between the two of you guys. It's been so dope hanging with you guys. I'll leave it to you guys for any parting words that you guys might have, and definitely let people know where they can find the Blue Collar Bitcoin podcast, which has just been putting out tremendous content.
So we are, we're active on Twitter at @blue_collarBTC. We both contribute. So both Dan and Josh were on there, kind of 50-50, just slinging stuff, kind of maybe 1/3 humor, 2/3 serious. We put out weekly episodes, our vibe is just, we're kind of hanging out, learning with the crowd. In terms of parting words for me, just start learning. I mean, that's kind of obviously I want you to buy some Bitcoin, but I would say just start learning, start soaking things in. In terms of resources, I would say right now, like, Josh has heard me sling. I mean, I'm like obsessed with Lynn Alden. Like, I think I'm reading every single thing she's ever written right now. Like, that's my priority. Now, some of it might be slightly over some people's heads that are new to the space, but I think any article she's written that's about Bitcoin is full of signal. That would be, in my opinion, a great starting place for a lot of people.
Awesome.
Yeah, I totally resonate with Lynn Alden. Just learn as much as you can about whatever it is you're deciding to invest in. I highly suggest Bitcoin. I think the Bitcoin Standard is a really good way to get started to understand the economics of it. What is the book by Jan Pritzker?
Inventing Bitcoin.
That's it. Yeah. Inventing Bitcoin is a great way to understand the tech side of it a bit. And Andreas Antonopoulos. I mean, a lot of his YouTube videos are kind of old and dated now, but the information is still relevant. Really good resource. And then, you know, today on Bitcoin Twitter, there are hundreds of people, just tons of good signal out there. Just read as much as you can. Just dive into this information and understand it. And Cedric, thanks for having us. We really enjoyed being here on your show, and we love what you're doing as well. And follow us.
Yeah, listen to Bitcoin Matrix.
Yeah, fellas.
Love your podcast, Cedric.
Thank you for buttering my muffin. I definitely agree. Lynn Alden is great. I just love the vision of seeing her on the TV in the firehouse. Andy Edstrom, Greg
that actually
Foss,
did happen.
Jan Pritzker have all been on the Bitcoin Matrix. So I hope you guys check those out. Those were very early episodes. But guys, it's really been a pleasure hanging with you guys. And it's been so dope. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All the best to you and your family, Cedric.
Thank you, guys. You too. Dan and Josh from the Blue Collar Bitcoin podcast on finance, economics, pensions, and the most important monetary technology of the 21st century, right here on the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. This episode was brought to you by Citadel Cabins, CypherSafe, Ledin, and the Bitcoin 2022 conference. And thank you for listening. Stack sats, stay humble, and stay laser focused. This is Cedric. Peace.